The 22nd Annual Christian Prayer Breakfast, Fort Worth, Tarrant County, was held Thursday, April 16, 2009, at the Amon G. Carter, Jr. Exhibit Building in West Fort Worth. A record number of citizens, almost 1,400, gathered with notable civic leaders to have breakfast, pray, and to hear our featured speaker. He was professional baseball's outstanding Texas Ranger, Josh Hamilton. Josh was interviewed by retired Texas Ranger great and the featured speaker of the event from 2006, Jim Sundberg. Listen now as these two athletes candidly discuss and reveal the power of an actual relationship with Jesus Christ to dramatically change life for the better.
He doesn't like all these long introductions, but I will do a little bit of an introduction here. And of course, I'm thrilled to have Josh with us. When I asked him I think it was either November or December to do this, he immediately responded to participate in this. This is one of the great events of Fort Worth and one that that I enjoyed speaking at a couple of years ago and have come to really appreciate. Josh was born on May 21st in 1981 in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Hey, do you want me to read it?
No, I got it. I think so. I think I can cover it. This comes off actually at about 10 o'clock today, but I do have some glasses here. Graduated from Athens Drive High School in 1999, named USA Baseball Player of the Year his senior year in high school, also Baseball America's High School Player of the Year, Tampa Bay's first round, first pick of the draft in 1999, All-State in nine states. No, that's really not true. We say that in baseball, that when you have these kind of credentials. He was an amazing high school player. And before we talk about the middle years between his high school years and baseball, I want to mention some of his statistics last year. Hit 304, 156 games played. Anybody who has played baseball understands the demand of a 162-game schedule in 180 days, and he played in 156 of those games, 190 hits, 35 doubles, 32 home runs, 130 runs driven in. And with that, he was one of only four players to win a player of the month in both April and May. Only one of four that have ever done that last year. One of only five Ranger players to hit 30 home runs, 30 doubles, 130 runs driven in. The other four was Gonzalez, Palmeiro, Alex Rodriguez, and Ivan Rodriguez, voted the Rangers Player of the Year, probably the most prestigious in terms of being a former player, and what a player like Josh would appreciate is that he was the Player's Choice Award for the AL's Most Outstanding Player. That's like being picked by the players, your colleagues, as the most valuable player. He was on the AL's Silver Slugger team, the Sporting News All-Star team, the AL All-Star team, and everybody saw the event in the Home Run Derby, which was fun for all of us to watch. Married to Katie, three children. Julia Shea is 8, Sierra Elise is 3, and Michaela Grace, not quite 1 year of age. So welcome, Josh Hamilton. Nice game last night.
That was a good game. Anybody see the game last night?
Got over with about 10:40. Got home about 12:30.
12:30.
Got 3 hours of sleep.
3 hours sleep. A lot of folks don't realize we, after the games are over, we actually go in and lift weights and work out and, you know, do a lot of other stuff. So it's not just show and go and then go home.
I knew that it would be a short night for Josh. I appreciate him being here. Last year went to Baltimore, and he and Johnny Nairn, in fact, Johnny Nairn, one of our coaches. Johnny, stand up.
Hey.
Johnny Nairn, hey. Josh and Johnny and I went to breakfast in Baltimore at about 5 in the morning. Team got in about 4, and And so I knew that it would be kind of a late night for you, and again, appreciate you being here. We're going to break this down into three segments. One kind of the early years of when he was growing up, and then one in the years of crisis, as we call it, and then the recovery years. And so, first of all, Raleigh, North Carolina, growing up, what was it like in Raleigh?
I was ordinary kid. I just loved playing sports, and my parents, growing up, loved sports too, but didn't get to play it as much as other kids. So they vowed that, if your kids ever wanted to play sports, they would give them every opportunity to do that. And that's what they did. I grew up, I had an older brother, 4 years older than me. Let me keep this right. 4 years older than me. And, he always made me better. He always pushed me. And you know how older brothers are. They wear you out. It was good for me. Childhood was great. It was one of those things where when my parents got off work, it was either whether it was basketball, baseball, or football, whatever season was in, that's what we were doing. So as soon as they get done working, we were gone, whatever it was. So, and they were very supportive and never pushed us or made us do anything we didn't want to do. I just always loved sports. And one of the things I like telling parents nowadays is, I went to church. I grew up going to church. I'll get this later. I didn't accept Christ until I was 18 years old. But when I was about 12 years old, we started playing AAU sports, AAU baseball, and traveling on the weekends. And I really got away from going to church. So one of the main things I like to tell parents, if you're going to do that, if you're going to put your kids, if your kids want to do that, stay in some kind of devotional or Bible studies, or stay in the Word somehow with your kids, because it's very, very, very easy to get separated and to get out of the routine of going to church and getting in the Word and being close to God.
I look at your story, I think really very similar. My younger years were involved around baseball, and everything was around baseball. In fact, in church, I grew up going to church and going religiously every Sunday, but I often played tic-tac-toe in the back row of the balcony, and so it really didn't mean much at that point to me. But when was the first time that you thought you liked baseball, or that there was something special that was going on?
Really?
Yeah.
When I was like 7.
I seen Tiger Woods swing a club at 2 years of age.
Yeah.
It comes early.
I loved it so much. When I was 7, I played with my brother who was 12. And that was the only year we got to play together because he was older than me. So that was pretty special for me. But, playing, I was hurting kids, making them cry, throwing the ball too hard, hitting the ball too hard. And so they actually moved me up to play with the 9 and 12-year-olds when I was 7 years old. And, I didn't know it at the time, but, it was when I got to high school, that's when about sophomore years, when I really knew I had a chance at maybe going on and playing professional baseball.
That's amazing. And you have a great story about your parents meeting and how your dad caught the eye, or your mother caught the eye of your dad. Yeah. So.
All right, I'm going to tell the story. My dad went to see one of his friends play a softball game, and his game got rained out, and the women were playing on the men's field. And there was a parking lot, and then the men's field was up here where a ball comes flying in the parking lot. Some woman had just hit a ball, 350 feet softball, slow pitch. And he's like, man, he said, I'd like to see who hit that. So he goes up, and next time she gets up, she hits it out of right field. Next time she hits it out of center, and next time she hits it off left field fence. And he said, man, I got to talk to her. So after the game, he goes up, introduces himself, and 4 months later, they're married. And it's been 30 years, no, actually 32 years now.
That's a great scouting report.
That's good, isn't it?
It's amazing. So you take after your mother.
My mom. I do. It's funny because when I'm not hitting well or something, she'll call me and she'll say, stop swinging like your daddy. And it's awesome.
You know, having been in high school and being scouted, you know, there's a tendency to have a lot of eyes on a person, especially of your caliber. Was there a lot of pressure your high school year, or were you just that far above that it was you could wake up and go out and hit?
Yeah, it was. You know, I always. And how many kids we got here today? A lot of kids here. Any kids? Raise your hand.
I see. Yeah.
Put the video games down. I mean, you can't get any better unless you go out and you play and you practice. You know, when my practice was over in school, you know, I'd stay after and hit more in the cage, or, you know, go home and hit off the tee. You know, I had a little net in the backyard, and I had a tee and a bucket of balls. And, you know, I knew what I wanted to do, and I had a goal in mind, and I knew I was focused and wanted to head in the right direction. So high school wasn't a problem. It was, you know, I guess I was an All-American kid in high school. You know, I never drank or did drugs or went to parties or did any of that stuff. You know, I was focused on doing my homework, making good grades, and, you know, playing baseball, and that's what I wanted to do.
What was it like when you found out that you've been drafted first pick in the draft? I'm sure you probably knew in advance that there was a chance that would happen, and mention a little bit, talk a little bit about that day.
June 2nd, 1999, it was, there's nothing wrong with my neck, I'm just trying to stay close to the microphone. It was my dad's birthday that day, and for guys out there, that's a great birthday present for your dad. And, you know, actually that day I got drafted, I had all my family there. We had like a house full of folks. I grew up in about a 1,400 square foot house, and it was packed to the brim, and people outside on the porch and media, and the funeral home let us borrow a tent for the media to, you know, stay out of the heat in, and pizza in. They gave us pizzas and Pepsi, gave us Pepsi products, and, you know, it was pretty cool. But quick story, I like telling little stories. The night before the draft, my brother and I, we decided to go fishing, and we love catfishing, and so we always want, it's called Lake Wheeler, and there's a dam, and it goes under the bridge, and there's rocks all down here, and I've always wanted to go fishing over here. So we do it. We go over there, and we're both wearing shorts and, you know, sandals, and we get down there, and there's a slab of concrete, and then the water's there, and we shine the light, and there's a snake right there. And he said, well, that's not good. So we walk over here, and we shine the light again, and there are snakes everywhere. I mean, it is crazy. It's like we fell in Indiana Jones. We fell into a pit of snakes.
And so were they moccasins?
They were, I don't know what they were. It was every kind of snake, I think, that would be in North Carolina was there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, he's like, oh, Lord. He said, what would Mom and Daddy do? They'd kill me if you got bit by a snake. So... this is the night before the draft, so, but anyway, I just thought I'd tell y'all that.
I hate catfish fishing. You have to sit still. You can sit still?
Yeah, I can sit still.
You can sit still that long?
I can sit still and stare at the end of the rod.
You just wait for that thing to pop down. Okay. Let's move into the years of crisis. I think one of the things.
I'm having fun. Why would we want to go there?
Well, we can have fun with this. We'll just keep having fun. The before I had heard your testimony, I was really found it interesting, and this is really shows that even though you become a Christian, that the temptation and the difficulty and the struggle does not stop. It often because of Christ's sacrifice, we're called to sacrifice, and with that comes tribulation and difficulty at times, but also in the midst of that abundant life. You talk about your first professional baseball stop and around receiving Christ into your life.
18 years old, you know, I get drafted, go to Princeton, West Virginia, and know something's missing. I get money. My parents are still, you know, keeping control of that. I get like an allowance still. You know, I'm 18, And so I go and I play and I come back and I'm in my aunt and uncle's living room, who I, you know, went to church with a lot growing up. And, you know, just I tell them, you know, something missed my life. And I had an experience in Princeton, you know, kind of a spiritual warfare deal, where I had a couple signs that the battle was on. So I accept Christ in my uncle, aunt and uncle's living room, and that was the beginning of the spiritual warfare. That very moment, I did that. You know, I didn't know how to grow spiritually. I didn't know how to get in the Word. I didn't know how to pray. I didn't know how to fellowship with other believers. I didn't know how to do any of that stuff. I just knew I needed Christ in my life, and I knew, you know, that's what I needed at that time. And that's what I need in general, put it that way. So it was not for two more years. You know, everything went fine. You know, I really wasn't getting into Word. I was going to church. I wasn't, you know, doing those things I needed to do to get closer, to have that intimate relationship with Christ. And, you know, I got in a car accident with my parents. And the two things that were consistent in my life at that time, my parents and baseball, were both taken away at the same time. And instead of, you know, having that...
What about the car? Your mother got hurt.
Well, my mom didn't actually get hurt. She actually had surgery on her neck, and then it was, you know, they had to cut her out of the car, and a dump truck ran a red light and hit us and T-boned us. And my dad actually fractured his skull, broke his collarbone, and I messed up my back a little bit. But that was the beginning of all the crisis.
And so what happened then? They were kind of pulled out of your life. Baseball was gone, and all of a sudden you're with a group of people that start to lead you in a different road.
Absolutely. You know, the biggest keys I hear when I talk to kids and, you know, youth groups is, and it's what my parents taught me, and I'm sure it's what you guys teaching your children, you know, people, places, and things. You know, if I'm not doing what folks are doing in a certain place at first, well, if I start hanging around them long enough and I'm there long enough, I'm going to start doing those things. Same thing with places. And I was going home. I was at the park every day at 7:30 in the morning, getting home at 12 in the afternoon. My family wasn't there. Baseball wasn't there. I had money. I was young. I went out and I kind of adopted a family, which was at a tattoo parlor. I don't have any tattoos.
I've thought about a tattoo. Where should I start?
Don't start.
Let's step back for a second. And I think one of the struggles I had when I first became a believer, I was at the age of 26, was trying to get in the Word. You mentioned the difficulty. For me, the difficulty was that I had a father that was kind of perfectionistic. I couldn't do good enough, and I couldn't do well enough for him, and no matter how well I did, I was falling a little short of the mark. When I got on the Word, I saw that condemnation all the time. I didn't see a loving, caring God. What I saw was a demanding, perfectionistic God in the Word. And so I began reading the Word through that window, and it was I had difficulty. I kept picking up and setting it down and really struggling with it. And it wasn't for about 3 years that I had a breakthrough in understanding that God of heaven was different than my father on earth, and that he was gracious and loving. What was your struggle there, and what breakthrough did you have? And of course, it would come, I know, after later on, but initially, what was the struggle for you?
Fighting ADD, and actually sitting down and you know, doing it. You know, I still struggle with that sometimes. You know, you get so busy in worldly things, you know, and the things we have to do on a daily basis that, you know, sometimes God gets pushed out because we're concentrating on everything but what really needs to be first, mm-hmm. and that's Christ and that relationship with Him. So, you know, it took me a while my body, I got tattoos of demons, devils, devil faces, you know, no eyes, me, no soul. Then I got Christ on the face on a cross on the back of my right calf. I mean, it was just, I mean, coming at me from every direction. And, you know, I didn't, you know, say, well, hey, I'm going to get that, you know, because of this. I was just getting things and getting them put on my body. And, you know, as I look back on it now, you know, I talked about that spiritual warfare. It was just, you know, rampant. And, you know, one of the last ones I got was that, you know, cross plugged in on the back of my calf. And, you know, I just look at that and it reminds me of, you know, who's behind me and who's in my corner. So, but I mean, for, let's see, 2 years, it was, you know, everything was good. And then I had the car accident and then hanging out at a tattoo parlor. And the first night I had my first drink, had my first line of cocaine, and I was at a strip club for the first time. So that was three firsts for me all in one night.
And so that had its root. You went through a period of trying to purge yourself of that. Just was having difficulty. Couldn't hang with it. All of a sudden, your relationship with your wife was deteriorating. Talk a little bit about how that went.
Well, it went. Let's see. I got once I started the drugs and alcohol, it was. You know, I used for about 8 times in 2 weeks. Went to a sports psychologist, talked about my injuries. He asked if there was anything else. I said, yes, I've tried drugs the last couple weeks. Next day, I'm on a plane to Betty Ford. Leave Betty Ford after 8 days because they tell me the reason I'm using it is because of my family. And I wouldn't hear any of that. So leave there, stay clean because I'm playing baseball again, get hurt again, and the cycle repeated itself. Went back to using. Make this quick. I dated my wife for about 4 months. We met, you know, after high school. We went to high school together. I tell people, you know, she was too good for me in high school. But
there's a lot of us like that.
I know.
I see a couple in the front row.
So 4 months we date, and then break up. And then 2 years later, we get back together. And it's 2004, and throughout this 2 year period, I'm, you know, using off and on, a bunch of rehabs, suspended from Major League Baseball, and all this. I actually go to her dad to get a job in construction, and Katie's selling homes on the sites, and so I'm always in the office instead of out there working, like I need to be, and so we. I'm clean for like 5 months. We get together for those 5 months, and then we get married. We get married 2004, November 10th. Ha, I remember. That's a good one. Got to remember.
You don't want to forget that.
You don't want to forget that. Get married November 10th. She gets pregnant December, and I go back out and relapse in January. And that was her first time dealing with relapse or anything like that, because she thought once I said I was done, I was done. And so I'm clean again for 5 more months, and she's pregnant, remember this, for 5 months, and then I relapse again, and it's this time it's bad. Like, it's not a one-day thing. It's, you know, off and on for the next 3 months. And actually, how bad it got was my middle girl was born August 22nd, and I was there for that and brought them home, and I went to pick up Katie's prescriptions at the drugstore and ended up at a bar and then ended up using again. And then shortly after that, she got a restraining order against me to get me out of the house so she could get it and sell it. And then it was, I had nowhere else to go and ended up at my grandmother's house.
You tell a story I heard before where you were, which I think is amazing, where you're walking down, you wake up and you're walking down a highway.
I woke up, I took something and blacked out. I was actually in a functioning blackout and don't remember any of it until I woke up in the middle of the country in the middle of nowhere on Highway 42 and two-lane highway, walking down the middle of the highway, cars passing me. And then I woke up out of it, and I didn't care enough to get out of the middle of the street. I just kept walking down the middle. That's how bad it had gotten, to where I didn't care, you know, if the car hit me or not.
You know, I played with a couple of guys back in the 80s that had spent some time out of baseball with cocaine, and I remember standing in the outfield during batting practice, and one of them telling me, you know, let me just tell you this. Don't even try it one time. Don't even try cocaine one time. We were hooked after that one time, and how it just is able to grab you. And that always stuck in my mind, and how difficult once that starts to get out of that. So you went to your grandmother's, and let's pick it up there. And you went to your grandmother, who really was someone that showed just continual faith and unconditional love in her grandson.
Unconditional love. And the same can go for I know my father-in-law wanted to kill me and choke me and, you know, everything else. But, you know, all he kept saying to me when I'd see him is, how you doing, son? How can I help you? I love you. What can I do for you? And, you know, he just always give me support and unconditional love. And, you know, I know it was hard for him, and that's only something you can get through the Lord. And so my grandmother was the same way. I mean, I showed up. My grandmother lived 100 yards from us growing up. You know, she was next door, and when something would go wrong, I was always at grandma's. And when I was hungry, I was at grandma's. And so she spoiled us growing up, but she never missed one game, you know, whether it be basketball, football, or baseball. Of me growing up, she never missed one game, and she never missed her first game until I became professional, and she couldn't travel to go get there. So she always told me I could come for any reason, anytime. And so I showed up one night. I had nowhere else to go. I couldn't go home. I was out of money, almost out of gas, and I just remember her saying, "You can come here for anything." And 2 o'clock in the morning. 2 or 3 o'clock, I showed up there, and it was, I weigh 240 pounds now, and I weighed 180 pounds, you know, when I showed up there and knocked on her front door. And she took me in, she fed me, I took a shower, she put me to bed, and she went in the room and cried. And over the next couple weeks, I used a couple times at my grandmother's house. And that's, you know, for that to happen, for me not to care that much to do that, it really, I mean, it turns my stomach now to think about me as that person and doing that to, you know, the people I love so much. But she saw I wasn't right one night, and she never actually saw me use, but she figured out something was going on, and she came to me, she confronted me, and all the things. And my parents had told me, you know, my wife, you know, people who love me, you know, you're killing yourself, you're a better person than this, you know, you could do great things, you know, you're killing us by making us worry, all these things. And I was actually, she told me all these things again, but I was actually high when she was talking to me. And when you have that drug, and I graduated from cocaine to smoking crack at this point. And it was, when you have this drug in your body, you know, you're numb. You don't feel feelings. You don't, you can't process anything in your head. And I was high when she was talking to me. And I know God opened my heart, and he cleared my mind, and he allowed me to see the pain and the hurt in her eyes and her face. And for the first time, I actually saw what I was doing and what I was doing to the people who loved me. And
so God used that moment to penetrate even the addiction, the depth of an addiction. He penetrated through that. You know, his word says it can penetrate through just about anything. And in this case, it can penetrate through anything. So he penetrated through the use of that so that he opened your heart and mind to what your grandmother was saying. And it was, and for the first time, convicted on a level you had not been before.
Absolutely. it was, you know, she had actually been battling for like this for 6 years. You know, she had like 6 or 7 different surgeries, open heart surgeries, you know, aorta valve surgeries, all of these different surgeries, and it wasn't the best, she wasn't in the best of health. And for her to take me in and to be there and for that moment to happen, you know, there was a greater purpose for that. So that happened, and then I went in my room, and the Bible, which had been there the whole time I was there, I picked it up, threw it on the bed, and as I read earlier tonight, James 4:7 was the first thing I read, humble yourself before God, resist the devil, and he'll flee from you. And I used that so many times, just over and over and over and over. And then I started going to church again, and I started getting in the Word, and I started praying, and I started doing all these things to spiritually grow and get closer with the Lord. And you know, that was kind of the beginning of me getting everything straightened back out.
So really, over from that time of your at your grandmother's house, over the next 6 months, you gradually began to get into the Word, let it filter through your heart and your mind, prayer. And did you set up an accountability system? Were there some other steps you made to put people around you that would encourage and support you?
Absolutely. You know, one of the biggest things, I mean, I watched a documentary on Billy Graham, and, you know, he never went anywhere without having someone with him, an accountability partner, and usually had 3 or 4 or 5 people with him. So it's always good to set yourself up with people who want to see you succeed, want to see you, you know, grow closer to God. I want to see you, you know, just be a productive man or woman or whatever it is, husband, father. You know, you need those people in your life to give you encouragement and to, you know, make sure what are the important things, they know you're there for them and whatever they can do for you.
In the struggle and the fight continues, only on a different level. And I remember you telling me one time that almost kind of a consequence of the earlier sin, and that you'll be driving along and the windows will be down, and all of a sudden you'll catch a whiff of something that smelled like something you'd done in the past.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, or either I'll smell something that I can taste what it tasted like. It's crazy. I mean, it's still that real, that you know, and that's the devil trying to catch you at a weak moment too. Mm-hmm.
And you take one day at a time, each day. And I think one of the things might be interesting to folks is, you know, when you go on the road, you take a bunch of cash and a bunch of credit cards on you.
Yeah, I'm loaded down to the gills. I don't take anything. My wife won't let me out of the. She don't let me go nowhere with nothing, which is part of my safeguard system. You know, Johnny Nairn. You know, when I got taken in the Rule 5 draft, Jerry Nairn was the manager of the Reds, and Johnny was with the Milwaukee Brewers at the time, coaching minor league ball, and it was I'd always thought about, you know, having somebody with me, or what if I could have somebody with me to help me out or help hold me accountable. And Johnny was the perfect guy for that. And I'd known Johnny since I was 8 years old. I grew up playing ball with his son, and basketball and baseball, and up through high school, and he coached me on one of my fall league teams. And so it was, and he's still here today. And another quick story. After my first year with Cincinnati, and this is we talk about a God thing. Listen to this. After my first year with Cincinnati, you know, Jerry Nairn had gotten fired at All-Star break, and Johnny, he was holding on, you know, to for me, he was holding on, and the Reds called me and told me, they said, we're not going to bring Johnny back. And I was like, really? They said, yeah, we're not going to bring him back. I told my wife this, and she's like, well, I have peace about it, and which I didn't think she would. And she said, I got peace about it, and Johnny said he did too. And then about a month later, I get traded to the Texas Rangers, and the first question they asked me is, what do you think about bringing Johnny Nairn with you? And I said, now I know why you had peace about it. I said, God knew what was going on. He was in control. You know, and I think that happens a lot of times, you know, especially when you're praying about things. And, you know, you have that peace and you just know God's in control of the situation. And, you know, when you can get to that, when you can get to that point and realize that He is in control and, you know, you stop fighting the battle and just let Him do it for you, that's when you start having that peace and can really focus on, you know, having that relationship with Him. So that's when I really, really, really knew He was in control.
You know, in a group like this, there's probably several people that have some form of addiction. What would you say to those folks and it could be a variety of a certain type of addictions, what would be your, what would you say to them?
Well, everybody has their own demons. You know, it's different. You know, the devil finds a ways, you know, he can get different people in different ways. You know, I look at the thorn in Paul's flesh, you know, don't know what it was. Never says what it was. But I know mine is alcohol and drugs. It gets me every time. So whatever that thorn is, you know what it is. So you do the things to take the safeguards that help you help prevent that thing from creeping up, or you pray about it, you know, you stay in the Word. That works. I mean, it really does. You know, when I start straying, and, you know, I stray sometimes from, you know, from getting in the Word. Like I said, I get busy. But the thoughts start creeping back in my head. But when I fill it with Scripture, when I fill it with God's Word, those things stay out. And if they pop in there, they pop right back out. So whatever that thorn in the flesh is, you know, you can beat it. And, you know, it happens with God's Word and, you know, relying on His promises.
Well, in closing and finishing up here, let's talk a little bit about the Rangers. What do you think the Rangers are going to do this year? Well, let me ask you a question that I think probably going through their mind. How do you handle a game when your team gives up 10 runs?
How do you handle it?
Yeah, the offense. Well,
we usually score 11. Yeah.
Actually, we're going to have a tryout here afterward. We're looking for pitchers.
It's physically, but more mentally exhausting. You know, last year it was to come to the park every day and to know you had to score, you know, at least 8 runs to be in the ballgame, what it felt like. But this year, I mean, yeah, the clubhouse is, I mean, it's an awesome clubhouse. The pitching, I mean, we've improved the pitching for sure this year. And, you know, going forward, it's all about confidence. Mm-hmm. Baseball is about confidence. You know that.
Oh, yeah. And I think, you know, being so close to the club and having played and watching you guys, you know, the loss in Detroit to me was a very difficult loss. You head 4-0, you go in the 8th inning, and pitching gives up 6 runs, and you talk about the thoughts that creep in. All of a sudden, what starts creeping in is this gonna happen again? Is this gonna be a rerun of last year? And then you end up having a lot of runs scored. The next night you lose a 10-9 game? Lose a 10-9 game. And then you lose a game in extra innings. And then so last night was a huge win to try to right the ship going into Kansas City over the weekend.
Some media guy asked me, he said, man, that was really exciting. I think we lost 10-9 loss. He said, that was really exciting. You know, that was, you know, the crowd was into it. I said, crowd ain't gonna keep coming to watch us lose 10-9. I said, they want to see some W's. So I want to see some W's. So, but, you know, you can't break the spirit in the clubhouse. We're going to score runs. And I've said it all along, you got to do all three. You got to pitch, you got to play defense, and you got to have offense. And if we can do all three of those things consistently, we'll be fine.
Well, I appreciate you coming out. Of course, we see each other quite a bit, but on behalf of everybody here, appreciate you getting up this morning, going on about 3 hours of sleep. I appreciate you coming out, and I know everybody here, continue to pray for Josh and myself. I mean, we all need to be lifted up and encouraged day to day, as the Word said. And anyway, appreciate you coming out and spending this time with everybody.